If you rule for us, you leave intact the president's powers, including every decision that every president has made in our lifetimes, and you preserve a status quo that has existed for decades. If you rule for him, you defer to the president in a way that history teaches us is very dangerous.
What the president did here falls squarely within his constitutional and statutory authority. I know they disagree with this president and many of his policy judgments, but none of that converts this into a constitutional crisis, and we respectfully submit that this court shouldn't treat it like one. It ought to leave this debate where it belongs, in the political arena.
Jeffrey Wall, the acting Solicitor General, and attorney Neal Katyal arguing for and against President Trump's travel ban today before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Seattle. The three-judge panel is hearing Trump's appeal of a lower court's decision that blocked Trump's executive order back in March. We also have an election happening here in Los Angeles tomorrow for seats on the city council and the school board, as well as a measure that would change the way police are disciplined. Well, here to update us on all of that is our legal analyst and elections Sherpa, Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. First, the travel ban in the Ninth Circuit.
Judge Gould, and may it please the court. Both the Constitution and acts of Congress give the President of the United States broad authority to prevent aliens abroad from entering this country when he deems it in the nation's interest.
Let's talk about what they were arguing in the first place. So they were arguing, they're basically discussing President Trump's revised travel ban, because earlier the same Ninth Circuit, a different panel of judges, had put a stay and injunction on President Trump's first travel ban. So the White House went back and reformulated it, revised it. And so how is the second one different from the first one?
Well, that's right. And we're still arguing about whether or not the district court was correct in granting an injunction. So this is an appeal of that lower court, the trial court, saying, yes, let's press pause on the new executive order. And the question is, should we keep in place the fairly broad injunction that was put in place by the trial court? Should we narrow it? Should we lift it entirely? And so the two different, quote unquote, travel bans are distinct because, one, the revised one does not include Iraq. Mm-hmm. It also does not permanently ban Syrian refugees, and it does not include green card holders, people who are already in the process of coming here, which eliminates a lot of due process concerns. We heard a lot of due process arguments the first time around. We don't hear that as much now. And it also doesn't include religious minorities in those Muslim majority countries, which means that it doesn't explicitly on its face give a preference for Christians in Muslim countries. So in other words, this is a new executive order that's a lot narrower. It is meant to respond to all of the previous suits. But the question really is, as you said, is it narrow enough? Doesn't it still raise real legal challenges? And certainly the plaintiffs in this case have said yes, because we still have standing. We're still harmed. You heard, for those people who listened or followed, there's a lot of discussion of, do we have standing? That really means, can the people who sued be in federal court? Do they have a constitutional harm that can be remedied?
And what is their argument? What is their hurt that they are arguing?
Well, they're different arguments. The argument is either I had a family member who was in the process of trying to come here. Now they can't. There's arguments on the basis of the state of Hawaii where they say we have a interest in maintaining our refugee program and that infringes on it. There's arguments that say people at universities, we need to be able to get foreign scholars. Now we can't get those scholars. People won't come. Businesses have said, for instance, it harms my business if I know that we can't have foreign travelers. So there's a lot of different arguments for standing. Then the arguments kind of move from, can you be in this court, to we heard the lawyers argue about what is this executive order really about? Is this President Trump saying that I, in the interest of national security, can prohibit certain people from coming in the country, that I can say I want more, quote unquote, stringent vetting? Or is this really a Muslim ban? And the question of whether we're in bucket A or bucket B falls into, can we consider context? Mm-hmm. So you heard the lawyers talk a lot about this thing called the Mandel Standard. We can talk about that in a second. A lot of which basically boils down to, President Trump used to be Candidate Trump, and he used to say a lot of things that sounded like we don't want Muslims in our country, or iterations of that statement.
And the question is, can you take the rough and tumble, the hurly-burly of the campaign and put that into the context of this very legalese document?
Exactly. So do we look just at the face of the document? So the Mandel case that we heard the justices talking about basically says if the we give the president a lot of deference, the president has a lot of leeway and judges can't do that much in this area, that the president, if he puts forward an executive order and on its face he can come up with a legitimate and bona fide reason, then that's basically the end of our inquiry. And the bona fide reason is national security. But the people challenging the travel ban have said, no, you have to look at context here. And the Mandel standard says you need a bona fide reason. There's an exception for bad faith. Here we have bad faith. You want to discriminate against people based on their religious background. So what they said is it's not just candidate Trump, but it's also President Trump. There was a discussion of, has he disavowed the statements that he made, which basically said, I want to ban all Muslims. And there, you heard the judges. I mean, this is extraordinary for judges to say, well, when did he make the statement that he doesn't want Muslims in? We have the attorney, Neil Katyal, who was challenging the ban, saying, I'm going to read to you a list of things that candidate and President Trump has said. He said he didn't disavow these statements.
And what did the Solicitor General say to that?
Well, the Solicitor General said, the acting Solicitor General, Jeffrey Wall, said, no, he's clarified since then. He has walked back the statements. He said this is about national security. And they both said, we need to look to the future. This isn't just about this ruling. So both of them said there's a scary, slippery slope if you vote against me, basically. Mm-hmm. And so what the acting Solicitor General said is, you can't look behind every president when they issue an executive order, particularly in immigration and national security. We just have to look at the face of the document, you know, follow the law. Don't look behind the curtain at all the really scary, abhorrent things the president said. And Neil Katyal, in favor of the plaintiffs, said, oh, this is unlike any other situation. You absolutely have to read this in context. Even the president says you need to look at this. And it would be scary if we just start to allow presidents to say, well, here's two words and on the face of it, it's not discriminatory. So court, you know, go ahead and uphold that. And so they're both saying danger lies ahead if you don't vote in my favor.
I just want to play a clip of tape from the president when he was signing the first travel ban, because they were discussing something he said in this signing ceremony.
And this is the protection of the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. We all know what that means. Protection of the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. That's big stuff.
Okay, so the phrase, the operative phrase there, we all know what that means. They both argued over that phrase, which I thought was interesting, that these were, six words that they were very intent on parsing.
Yeah, we all know what that means. Isn't that a model of clarity? Isn't that how we want to ensure that we're making immigration law? Well, we all know what the blank means. So does it mean, and this comes back to our central question, does it mean I'm protecting national security, I'm the president, I have broad authority in immigration, and we all know what that means, all I'm doing is saying no terrorists? That's permissible. Or is it saying, as I've told you, American people, since I started running, no Muslims in this country. And that's what the executive order means. And that's what I've said before. And therefore, this is entirely consistent with all my other statements. Now, for us to be arguing about, we all know what that means in the Ninth Circuit. I mean, we truly live in extraordinary times. This is, you know, hearkening back to, some of your listeners may remember, President Clinton's, depends on the meaning of what is. Uh-huh. I mean, as a law professor,
or
I live for these moments.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have to say, listening to this, it was, I thought, very high level, fantastic lawyering. And that phrase, I mean, you just, both lawyers probably thought, God, this is just the paragon of kind of open to interpretation. I mean, he might as well have said, so this is reasonable. What's reasonable?
Yeah. Okay. So the two lawyers, they ended their arguments and actually hugged each other afterwards, which
I did think I saw a little hug. And there are very few people in the world who, one, are experiencing this moment and who can argue at this high level. I mean, we're talking about very intricate and thoughtful arguments. And all of the Ninth Circuit judges said at the end, you know, thank you for your thoughtfulness.
Mm. And so this will go to the Supreme Court.
I think that it will.
Either way. Yes. Do we know when a decision might be reached?
I don't. And I've been, you know, famously fantastic at predicting the timeline for these things. But it's I mean, I'm going to kind of punt and say it's obviously on an accelerated timeline.
Yeah. OK. Very briefly, we did bring you in here, schedule you to talk about the election that's tomorrow here in Los Angeles, but we only have 2 minutes left. So what is the takeaway? We have done a lot of coverage on this election, but the city council races and also the school board races. And there's a measure on the ballot that would fundamentally redo the way police are disciplined. What's your brief takeaway?
Well, my brief takeaway is it's going to be very low turnout. For people like me where I live, please don't look at my address. I only had one thing. I'm voting on Measure C, which would say for police officers that are facing certain disciplinary actions, you can appeal to an all-civilian board. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Right now, there are, as your listeners know, you can appeal to a board which is two people who are in higher levels at the LAPD and one civilian. The police union, who used to not want any civilians on the board, realized, oh, studies show actually that the civilian member tends to be more lenient to the LAPD officer facing discipline. The police union, as will shock everyone, is actually quite powerful in LA, and therefore we will be voting on a proposal to allow three civilians to be the entire panel. And we have to vote on it because it changes the charter. Whenever you change the charter, the people have to weigh in. The two city council races, I think, I mean, you've covered this a lot. I think Joe Braille has essentially imploded in a way that few of us have seen in recent history, in the luckiest moment for Gil Cedillo. And then we have two important LAUSD races, which are matching up to be what we've seen for a long time now, which is in one corner we have the charter school camp, and in another corner we have those who are in favor of the teachers union. And I think that this election could change the balance of power in LAUSD, which is enormously important to many of us.
Yeah, and then huge amounts of money involved, more than 600,000 students' futures involved. It's a big deal.
Oh, just that, yes.
Just that. So go out and vote. All right. Jessica Levinson, it's always great to see you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School. She's also president of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission. And we want to hear from you. How do you plan to vote in tomorrow's runoff elections? You can tell us who you're supporting on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Roger Stone has a reputation as the political prince of darkness. The longtime Republican operative pops up in nearly every infamous moment in the party's last 40 years. Watergate, the Florida recount, even this past election.
Roger always wanted me to run for president. And over the years, every time a presidential race came up, he always wanted me to run. And I just didn't have interest at that time.
Roger Stone's career and his role molding Donald Trump into a presidential candidate are the subjects of a new documentary. It's called Get Me Roger Stone. It's out now on Netflix. And joining us now to talk about it are two of the three directors of the movie, Morgan Pekma and Dan DeMauro. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. All right. So just to set the scene, Roger Stone really has the looks to match his over-the-top personality. He has these flashy pinstripe suits. He's got this head of snow white hair that rivals President Trump's. He wears these thick, circular, black-rimmed glasses. And most notably, he has President Nixon's face tattooed on his back. All to say that he's not your typical bland political operative in Dockers. But were you surprised at all by how seemingly ever-present he's been in American politics over the last few decades?
Well, Madeline, this is Morgan. You know, that's exactly why we wanted to make a film about him, because we thought that by telling Roger's story, we would be able to shed light on American political history since Watergate. And as you said, he's such a charismatic oddball character. He's a bodybuilding, pot-smoking dandy, and he and his wife were exposed by the National Enquirer's swingers. And so what we always wanted to do was make a film that was insightful about our politics, but that would be interesting to people who even had no interest in politics whatsoever.
And you didn't know when you began following him 5 years ago that he would have such a central role in Donald Trump's run for president, right?
That's right, Madeline. We started following him actually 5.5 years ago. He was really at a low point. He was the down and out dirty trickster kind of looking for his next big score. And we had no clue that at the end of our documentary, at the end of 5.5 years filming with him, that he would actually be at the apex of his career.
Let's begin at the beginning. And he's really begins his political scheming in elementary school during the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon election. I want to play a clip of tape from your movie where Stone talks about how he got his fellow students to vote for Kennedy.
I went to the cafeteria, and as each kid would go through the cafeteria line with their tray, I would tell them, you know, Nixon has proposed having school on Saturdays. Well, then the mock election was held, and to the surprise of the local newspaper, Democrat John Kennedy swept this mock election. For the first time ever, I understood the value of disinformation. Of course, I've never practiced it since then.
Ha ha. Right. So what, you know, so he starts really young, and is that really the through line through his political career?
Yeah, you know, there's always a temptation to try to psychoanalyze a person like Roger and say, what was the horrible trauma that made him such a devious, dirty trickster? Well, the truth is Roger had a very pedestrian, middle-class upbringing. His parents loved him. There's no horrible trauma that we know about in his past. But what is true is that from his earliest days, he was always infatuated with politics, and particularly the dirty trick side of politics. And he is an incredible prodigy as a political operative. He was the youngest person called before the Watergate grand jury when he was all of 19 years old.
This enormous chart was put up in which everyone who received money from this secret fund was put on the wall, and it said Gordon Liddy, McCord, Segretti, and then way down at the bottom it said Stone.
I paid $100 to Mr. Roger Stone on one occasion.
My parents called me on the phone. They were mortified. I thought it was pretty cool.
So Roger is as much a political animal as anyone on earth.
Well, speaking of Watergate, we mentioned that tattoo, that Nixon tattoo on his back. He tells you in the movie the reason behind it. Here's a clip.
His greatest single quality is resilience, and that's the purpose of my tattoo. It's not an ideological statement. It's a reminder that in life, when you get knocked down, you have to get back up off the canvas and keep pushing, get back in the game. That's the story of Nixon. A man is not finished when he is defeated. He's only finished when he quits.
Why is Nixon his hero?
So Roger says that his tattoo is not a statement that he agrees with Nixon's ideology, but that's actually a convenient narrative for him. We actually show in the film that he very much embodies Nixon's mentality, which is win at all cost.
Can you point to an example of a quintessential dirty trick that Roger Stone orchestrated?
So in order to neutralize the Reform Party that had been run by Ross Perot and had a lot of ways taken away enough votes from the Republican candidate for Bill Clinton to win in both 1992 and 1996, Roger dreams up the scheme of getting Pat Buchanan to run on the Reform Party line, get the nomination on the strength of his celebrity, and then Roger had an unbearable secret about Pat Buchanan that he used to blackmail Pat Buchanan so that he wouldn't really run. And on top of that, he introduced Donald Trump as another candidate in the race for the Reform Party nomination. And Trump didn't so much run for the presidency as he was just set out to destroy Pat Buchanan.
I guess he's an anti-Semite. He doesn't like the blacks. He doesn't like the gays.
What's wrong with Pat Buchanan?
Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? And he's obviously in love with Adolf Hitler in some form. And I don't think the Reform Party should be taking losers. Have a good time.
Bear in mind that the arch strategist of the Trump campaign is Roger Stone.
Yeah, I may have played some role in derailing them as a party.
The fallout was so profound that Pat Buchanan polled just a measly 1% of the vote and completely destroyed the third party that the Reform Party had emerged as. And in that, in doing so, he destroyed any chance that of siphoning votes away from the Republican Party. So it was an absolute watershed moment in our history.
How does Pat Buchanan feel about Roger Stone?
Pat Buchanan was one of the only people who declined to give us an interview who we sought one with.
Okay. Well, that answers that question. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Morgan Pekma and Dan DeMauro. They directed the new Netflix documentary, Get Me Roger Stone. Stone is the Republican consultant who helped launch Donald Trump's political career, and he is really a larger-than-life character. Can you talk about how he enters Trump's orbit and what his shaping has led to? How important was Roger Stone in shaping the Donald Trump we see today?
Well, Madeline, this is Morgan. And, you know, it was absolutely, Roger played as integral a role in the Trump presidency as anybody. Roger first meets Donald Trump in the early 80s, and they're introduced by their mutual mentor, Roy Cohn, who was an infamous lawyer and political fixer in New York City. And Trump and Roger hit it off from the beginning. Trump becomes a client of Roger's in Roger's mega lobbying firm, Black, Manafort & Stone. People may know of it because of Paul Manafort, who later became Trump's campaign chairman. And that business was the first one that intermingled lobbying with campaign consultancy. So they elected people, and then they turned around and made a profit by lobbying the people they had just put in office. And at a certain point, it occurs to Roger that Trump would be the ideal candidate for president. This is in 1987. He's already thinking about it. And he's been beating the drum for it ever since. He stayed between 87 and 2016, Trump's chief political advisor. And all throughout the early year of the Trump campaign, the one that happened before Trump made the announcement of his candidacy, that was being, it was a three-man team led by Roger Stone. And so Roger has shaped the political philosophy that has been the through line of Trump's campaign.
We created ISIS, the vacuum created by George W. Bush, and then Hillary Clinton armed ISIS.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder.
She's got no stamina. I think it's abundantly clear.
She doesn't have the strength or the stamina to make America great again. Believe me.
People behind Trump's candidacy, including Giuliani, including Roger Ailes, including Roger Stone, including his so-called brain trust, believe this stuff works.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe.
And yet he was fired, right, as a campaign advisor?
Well, I think as our film demonstrates, that allowed Roger to distance himself officially from the campaign and yet still stay as an integral operative that was running the outside game to help Trump get elected, both through his role as a major player in the as an alt-right media figure, through running a super PAC that Roger set up after his departure from the campaign, and most importantly, through installing his old partner and lifelong friend Paul Manafort as the campaign chairman and driving the campaign during the most important stretch.
So Manafort loses his job for his alleged ties to Russia. And then Roger Stone apparently has bragged about communicating with Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, and who published those emails, the famous DNC hacked emails, although he claims that he doesn't know where they came from. What is Roger Stone's role in this whole Russia mess?
To a large degree, we're waiting to see the results of these various investigations just as much as anyone is. We do know and can say for a fact that we know Roger was actively trying to get in touch with Assange. We don't know if he ever did or how he did, if he did. We do know that he was communicating with Guccifer, the alleged hacker of the DNC, but as he says and he has released their correspondence, it was after the hack. So there's kind of a dead end there to connecting it to some sort of collusion. But at the same time, that's just the one conversation that he has released.
He has agreed to testify in front of Congress. Do you think his testimony could be revelatory in any way?
I think that Roger is eager to address the Russia allegations because he doesn't want to have the feds probing all his business. You know, Roger has been so adept at going up to the line of potential illegality and not crossing it. So his dirty tricks only go so far, but he certainly doesn't want to wind up indicted or prosecuted. And Roger inserts himself into things that he may not have had anything to do with. And in this case, he may have bitten off more than he had intended to chew.
What is his motivation? What does Roger Stone want?
We think Roger Stone ultimately wants his place in history. And I think our documentary does make the case that he does have a place in transforming and shaping our politics over the last 40 years.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers. Everything I have done, everything I have worked for, is to propel ideas and a political philosophy that I want to see dominant in government. Donald Trump has now elevated the issues that I believe in. Anti-elitism that was first identified by Richard Nixon.
To you, the great silent majority.
Mined by Ronald Reagan.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And now Donald Trump.
The silent majority is back, and we're going to take the country back.
But what we've also learned that we found he's very similar in a sense to Trump is that ultimately his ideology is winning.
I want to play a clip of tape of him. It's a very short clip of tape of him, but it pretty much sums up Roger Stone, or at least the Roger Stone that is portrayed in public. You ask him what message he would have for people who will loathe him after seeing your movie, and here's his answer.
I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
So does that pretty much sum it up?
Absolutely. Roger is absolutely full on willing to accept any type of hatred that you want to throw his way. And that has been an essential part of his image. But there's also an element of misdirection to it, because by reducing him to this cartoonish villain, that obscures the actual effect that he has had in shaping our politics. And it blurs the responsibility that he bears for so many of the things that hollowed out the safeguards in our system. And that was one of our guiding principles. We never wanted to lose sight of the effect that Roger had, despite the fact that he is such an extraordinary, watchable character, both from the perspective of whether you detest him or if you love him.
Morgan Pekma and Dan DeMauro, their new documentary, Get Me Roger Stone, is streaming now on Netflix. Thank you both.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Emmy Award-winning producer Brad Gray died of cancer yesterday. He was 59 years old. The former chairman and CEO of Paramount Pictures shepherded many hit movies into theaters, films like Transformers and Star Trek.
My name is Optimus Prime. We are autonomous robotic organisms from the planet Cybertron. But you can call us Autobots for short.
Autobots.
What is it with you, Spock? Your planet was just destroyed, your mother murdered, and you're not even upset.
If you are presuming that these experiences in any way impede my ability to command this ship, you are mistaken.
And yet you were the one who said fear was necessary for command. Did you see his ship? Do you see what he did?
Here now to help us look back at the career of Brad Gray is Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hey, Kim.
Hello, Madeline.
So you knew Brad Gray for many, many years. And when was the last time you were in touch with him?
2 weeks ago, and wow. I have to tell you, there was no inkling of illness. He knew he had been battling cancer. He kept that extremely private. I mean, I was about as close with Brad Gray as any reporter will be with a source, and yet he never uttered one word. I emailed him 2 weeks ago because I hadn't heard from him for a bit. We used to talk very, very often, and the subject line I just looked back was, "Are you still with us?"
Oh, wow.
And he said, of course, I had no idea. He said, "Barely, I'll call you." And he never did. And now I know why. And I'm, like many people in Hollywood, absolutely shocked.
Very, very sad. He led Paramount for 12 years. And how was his tenure? What did Paramount look like when he got there and when he left in February?
Well, look, you know, I mean, I'm a journalist and I'm objective about this, and I don't think anyone could make a serious argument that Brad Gray left Paramount in better shape than he found it. You know, he had a very rocky tenure. Paramount was run, many people felt it wasn't really operating as a full-fledged studio by the time he left. The studio lost over $400 million last year. You know, it was, he would ultimately blame Philippe Domon, that the now ousted head of Viacom, for just choking off money to the studio. But I think objectively speaking, it has to be said that, you know, they managed for short-term results and to try and make the numbers look as good as possible. And this is an illness that pervades the industry right now, is that people are rewarded for short-term results and they do very well. They get bonuses often based on that. And it's not necessarily the best thing. Paramount was left in very poor shape. But however, I will say that Brad Gray associated himself with a lot of prestige films. He would want you to remember, he want everybody to remember, that before he went to Paramount, he was associated with The Sopranos, that he was a producer on The Departed, which was, so he had not only Emmys, but Oscars, you know, Gary Shandling show. Mm-hmm. He and Gary Shandling got into a bitter fight, Gary Shandling alleging that Brad Gray had conflict of interest and was taking advantage of him. They ultimately settled. I'm not sure. I mean, I would say to Brad, and probably did at some point, you know, Gary Shandling probably had a great point there. And the thing I found so engaging about Brad is he was grounded in his own reality. He would admit, at least to me, off the record, you know, what the reality was. And when the reality wasn't great, which certainly at Paramount, it often wasn't great, he didn't pretend it was. He wasn't one of these guys who's like, yes, our Arthur movie at Warner Brothers on King Arthur is going to be a huge hit. He would know that something bad was going to happen, right, and he wouldn't pretend otherwise.
Right. So before that, he was an agent, right? He started out.
He was a manager.
Or manager. Okay.
He started with Weinstein Company very early on as a concert promoter, but he was at Bernie Brillstein. It was Brillstein Gray. Bernie Brillstein, a legendary manager of talent like John Belushi and Bill Murray, you know, huge personality. And Bernie Brillstein saw Brad as he used to say he would be the next Mike Ovitz, that he would come to dominate Hollywood. They had a very complicated father-son, full of betrayal and love relationship. Mm-hmm. And then he really surprisingly went from being a manager at Brillstein Gray, again, you know, after this battle with Gary Shandling and other clients like Bill Maher, he one day, it seemed to me, and I told him so at the time, kind of out of the blue, became head of Paramount Pictures.
So you gave an indication that he was a straight shooter, like an all-around pretty good guy. And when you think of people who are at the top of this business in Hollywood, good guy, those are two words that you don't really put together very often.
I don't want to oversimplify. Brad was complicated, and a lot of people would say, I remember someone at Brillstein Gray saying to me that Brad Gray is on a rocket ship for one. And I think that's fair. But having said that, he was charming. He was funny. He had a lacerating sense of humor. I mean, I don't know if I once told him I had a 5-hour lunch with Warren Beatty, and he immediately said, "What, you only had the appetizers?" And he was, you know, he was so smart. And yes, he did take care of himself first. I don't think anyone would deny that who was dealing in reality. And including Brad, you know, he wanted to do well by himself, and he did. He had a long tenure at Paramount, notwithstanding a very bumpy tenure. So, you know, in terms of hits and misses. So you know, and he had, you know, he was associated with some absolutely fantastic entertainment, and I don't want to imply that we're shorting him on that, mm-hmm. but I don't want to say yes, he was a truly wonderful humanitarian, because yeah. he wasn't.
Okay. Kim, we've just run out of time, but I want to
maybe complicated, not, Madeline.
Yeah, people are complicated, and
but I want to say I am very sad about this, because I really, really had a wonderful relationship with Brad Gray, and I will miss him so much.
Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kim Masters, editor at large of The Hollywood Reporter. She's host of KCRW's The Business. And we've been remembering Brad Gray, who died yesterday at the age of 59. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You may not know the names Harold and Lillian Michelson, but you have definitely seen their work.
Harold and Lillian enhanced the quality of movies. Both of them are these secret weapons that nobody talked about, but everybody was trying to get.
Most people don't know what a storyboard artist is, and yet, you know, here it's obvious that Harold was responsible for one of the most iconic moments in cinema history.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
Harold worked as a storyboard artist and Lillian as a researcher on hundreds of films, including classics like The Birds, The Graduate, Scarface. Their careers and their 60-year marriage is the focus of a new documentary. It's called Harold and Lillian, A Hollywood Love Story. And the film's writer and director, Daniel Rame, joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Harold was a storyboard artist, Lillian a researcher. Most people don't know what that means. What does a storyboard artist do first?
Sure. So storyboard artists, I mean, Alfred Hitchcock was famous for creating these elaborate storyboard continuity sketches that show us exactly what the camera sees frame for frame, cut for cut. So Harold Michelson worked with Hitchcock, worked with DeMille, and he helped them visualize their ideas, bring them to life on paper.
Most satisfying is doing storyboards. There's a place where you are in a room and you're practically a whole studio yourself and you just draw. Just the idea of creating your idea, you're kind of directing visually on sketching, and that is very satisfying.
You mentioned Hitchcock, and you notice in the movie, in your movie, that it seems like Harold really made that movie, that shot for shot, Hitchcock films what Harold has drawn.
That's right. So in a way, Hitchcock's method of working was that he would gather his key collaborators in a room and Harold Michelson, storyboard, costume, makeup, editor, cinematographer, everyone's there before the script's written. And Hitchcock would go through shot by shot what's in his mind. And Harold would make these thumbnail sketches. As the locations were found and as the sets were being designed and as the script was being written, Harold would visualize the scenes. I mean, he would take basically what is action and dialogue on paper and translate that into cinema. And he learned a lot working with Hitchcock, but it's important to note, or the film explores how 2 years later, when he was working on The Graduate for Mike Nichols, he really had like carte blanche to devise what became some of the most iconic images in film history.
Including the iconic image from that movie, which is the shot of her bent leg. That's and right. You see Dustin Hoffman through the triangle.
That's her. Right. And that was his intention was to show the sexual charged, you know, sexual charge of that moment, which wasn't in the script as a description of how to shoot it. It was like they're in a room talking. And Harold, in his mind, was like, how do I make this visually interesting?
There's another interesting shot in that movie that Harold designed. It's of Benjamin, Dustin Hoffman, sitting in bed post-coitus. I guess they're in a hotel room, and he's just looking at the TV, and she, Mrs. Robinson, is going back and forth in front of him as he's watching the TV getting dressed.
That's right, and I love that sequence. As Harold describes it, we see her from the neck down, and every time she passes by, I think that's, again, a testimony to Harold's contribution to a film like The Graduate. And I think it's important to note that cinema is such a collaborative medium. It's an amazingly collaborative medium. And it doesn't really matter who came up with which shot. What matters to me in making this film is that Harold and Lillian never got credited for their work. Nobody knows about what they did.
Well, Lillian, what did she do?
She also was working from the very beginning behind the scenes. So let's say when De Palma is going to begin working on Scarface, he and the production designer and the screenwriter will turn to Lillian to find out what a drug lord's, you know, what that world looks like. And she will bring authentic information, even if she has to, which she did, call her friend, a drug lord, to, and it wasn't just one phone call. Like she was invited to South America to find out what a drug lord's, you know, world looked like. So that was part of, she found for designers and for film people what you're not allowed to see. It's pretty amazing what she did.
So she had her own library, and I was surprised to learn that there are actual libraries on movie lots. I didn't know that. On studio lots. I didn't know that there were private libraries. What was in that library?
Well, she purchased, so she was a volunteer at the Samuel Golden Research Library in the early 60s, and they took a life loan, they took a loan and purchased this library when the studios were dismantling in the late 60s. And she carried that library with her literally for, to five different film studios. So for example, at one point she and her library are homeless, and Francis Ford Coppola established a studio in Hollywood called the Zoetrope, and which lasted for 2 years, but he wanted to make that like an old-fashioned studio and invited Lillian and her research library to take over the bungalow. It's the same bungalow from the opening of The Player. I mean, that was Lillian's research library, and that was a hub for not just books and research and Lillian, who was amazing, but for people to kind of come and have tea and doing whatever they did back then and hanging out and talking about the creative process.
So really, she and her research gave directors ideas of how the movie should look, how it should be authentic, and even ideas in terms of plot points and character development?
It would translate into that. She referred to herself in an interview as a secret storyteller, and she was in many respects, because she would find information that did manifest into story points as well, yes.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Daniel Rame, the writer and director of the new documentary Harold and Lillian, A Hollywood Love Story. It's a documentary in theaters now. And the other part of this is their love story, and they were married for 60 years. And it really is touching how incredibly close they were. Can you talk about their relationship?
Lillian and Harold met at the end of World War II. She was his kid sister's best friend. She was 17, this brilliant bookworm orphan who he had his eye on her and invited her to elope to Hollywood and kind of leave behind that world that from when they were in Miami Beach, Florida. And the film depicts the arc of this kind of extraordinary 60-year marriage and the tensions of married life in Hollywood, where oftentimes you're out on location, but all the other things, they were raising an autistic son among two other sons in the 1950s when autism was never heard of. They're two extraordinary characters, two extraordinary souls that beyond their amazing contributions to cinema, I felt there was a beautiful story. And Lillian truly bared her soul in this film to really give us a window into the secret sauce that makes a marriage work for 60 years.
What is that secret sauce? I need to know.
Well, I think it's the film kind of collectively expresses that. So giving it in one word, you know, is hard. Like here's the ingredients. But a part of it was the fact that they were working in the same, not just the same industry, but they really supported each other's work. She would feed him ideas and information and images that would support Harold's storyboards. And then when Harold was up for the job to become the production designer of Star Trek, the motion picture, the first one, he wasn't a Trekkie, but Lillian was. And she prompted him, and he was then nominated. But beyond that, I mean, he really devised the world that we know and love today that we see on the cinema screen.
What's also really sweet about their relationship are these cards that he would send to her. He would make these incredibly detailed and ornate cards and write these poems for her.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, there was a deeply loving relationship that unlike I've ever come across. I mean, and over those years, it's like the honeymoon never ended for Harold. And so he so loved Lillian. And the story is basically the heart for me and the soul of this film is Lillian's inner story and how she had to overcome the challenge of coming out of kind of a difficult, brutal, as she called it, early family life and being raised in orphanages and and basically have a loving marriage.
All my life circumstances had to be fought against and resisted and made to fit me as a person. So I never felt that I was really worthy of anybody's sustained and consistent love. I was thrilled by it, but secretly I never thought I deserved it. That's why I loved the poem so much.
So he died, Harold, several years ago.
Yeah.
She's still here, still full of life.
Absolutely.
How is she living, though, without him?
Yeah, she is now at the Motion Picture Home in Woodland Hills, and she's still doing great in terms of just her spirit is still really as strong. And part of the process of making this documentary was interviewing Lillian over 18 months and going deeper and deeper into their life story. And I think she's misses him deeply and has not kind of moved on by way of finding another life partner, which some people I think do at the Motion Picture Home in their late life.
Well, Daniel Rame, writer and director of Harold and Lillian, A Hollywood Love Story, thank you so much for coming in today.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.